meditation and contemplation. I had left it to you, but I'll read with you. What is the difference between meditation and contemplation? This is best understood when we have done both ourselves. But still, by reading, we may ask ourselves whether we have ever done what is described here. Yesterday we read what Sri Aurobindo says about meditation. I told you the next paragraph tells us about contemplation. You might not have read at home, doesn't matter. We shall read here together. Let us revise first what we read yesterday about meditation, and then we shall contrast it with contemplation by reading the next paragraph. The first step in concentration must be always to accustom the discursive mind to a settled, unwavering pursuit of a single course of connected thought on a single subject. And this it must do undistracted by all lures and alien calls on its attention. Such concentration is common enough in our ordinary life. Very often when we see a film, this concentration is very often available. A good film, when you see, you don't like anybody to be disturbed. You don't like any other call. You want to be settled on the subject that is before you. So it is common enough, but it becomes more difficult when we have to do it inwardly, without any outward object or action on which to keep the mind. Yet this inward concentration is what the seeker of knowledge must effect. Now there is a footnote that Sri Aurobindo has written. In the elementary stages of internal debate and judgment, vitarka and vichara, for the correction of false ideas and arrival at the intellectual truth. So this kind of concentration in which, for example, what we are doing now, although our eyes are open and we are talking inward outward, it can be used as a first stage of meditation, because we are concentrated now upon one fixed subject, and that subject is a subject connected with your internal being. It's not a subject regarding what happened there or what happens here. It is concerning the inner understanding. Your object is an internal thought. Meditation is an internal process, and we are now discussing that internal process. So you might say that what we are doing now is already a kind of meditation, the first stage of meditation. So in that, even some debate also is possible. If there is a judgment going on in the mind, even that is possible as a starting point. Although ultimately debate must stop and even judgment must stop ultimately. But in the beginning, even this process is also permissible. But this is the inward concentration must be effected. This is the first point. Every person who really wants to meditate should arrive at this point, inward concentration. a concentration upon something that is inner, something that is inward in our being, that should be the object on which our ideas should be fixed. Then second condition that is described is, nor must it be merely the consecutive thought of the intellectual thinker. As I said, in the first place, debate is allowed, judgment is allowed, but now, it must not be merely that process. You must go beyond it. So it must not be merely the consecutive thought of the intellectual thinker, whose only object is to conceive and intellectually link together his conceptions. It is not, except perhaps at first, a process of reasoning that is wanted. At first, reasoning is perfectly all right, but it must not be limited. We must go beyond the process of reasoning. Instead of reasoning process, there should be another, what Sri Aurobindo calls dwelling. There's a difference between reasoning process and a process of dwelling. What is dwelling? To dwell is to repeatedly come back to the same point. Instead of developing a reasoning process, you dwell upon the same point. This is more difficult. To move forward and backward is easier for the mind. But to come back again to the same point is more difficult. And what is wanted is dwelling. So dwelling so far as possible on the fruitful essence of the idea. There is a difference between understanding an idea, developing an idea, consecutively linking together the ideas. This is one process. The other is to go to the essence of the idea. So there is a difference between linking together ideas, one after the other, and the process of essence of the idea. You hear a long lecture, for example, and after hearing the lecture, I ask you, what is the essence of the lecture? If you are supposed to report what you heard, there can be two kinds of reports. One is that you recount the entire lecture one by one, different ideas which I put forward. You say, first he said this, then he said this, then he said this, then he said this. That is one kind of reporting. It is an account of a consecutive process of thought. But another way is that basically what he said is this. Essentially, what he said is this. I may give a lecture on Karma Yoga, a long lecture on Karma Yoga. And then, if you are asked, what is it that he said ultimately, basically? So you can simply say, essence of the idea is not to desire and to come out from the idea that I am the doer. That is the essence. I may give a long lecture in which I have given all the ideas, in which many ideas may have come, but essence, if I ask the question, what is the essence? In two words, give up the desire, and secondly, liberate yourself from the idea that you are the doer of action. This is the essence of Karma Yoga. So if you are inwardly discussing what is Karma Yoga, you may read 10 books or a long lecture or a long essay in which many ideas are linked together. But if you are asked, what is the essence? What Sri Aurobindo says is that in meditation, meditation is to be distinguished from a long line of reasoning on the one hand, which can be allowed as a starting point. But you should arrive as soon as possible through a point where you ask what is the essence of the idea or series of ideas, catch that essence and dwell upon it. Then you go forward. This is what now Sri Aurobindo says. So far as possible on the fruitful essence of the idea, which by the insistence of the soul's will upon it must yield up all the facets of its truths. So when you get hold of the essence, then all the aspects of the truths of that essence are immediately delivered. Now Sri Aurobindo gives an example so that we may understand it better. Thus, if it be the divine love that is a subject of concentration, it is on the essence of the idea of God as love that the mind should concentrate in such a way that the various manifestation of the divine love should arise luminously. Not only to the thought, but in the heart and being and vision of the sadhaka. What is the essence of the idea of God as love? Now let us consider it and let us meditate ourselves so that it may be easier for us to grasp what is meditation. The essence of the idea of God as love. Now let us make an exercise ourselves. Let us put together all the ideas that you may have of God as love. And then we shall examine what is the essence of the idea of God as love. What is love? Basically, that is the question. What is love? Very often, love ordinarily means a sensation. Ordinarily, a sensation in the heart which moves out to grasp an object in which there is a great pleasure. This is the minimum that happens in the expression of what people call love. There is a sensation in the heart, which impels you to move out of yourself towards an object, to grasp it, and to enjoy pleasure that is obtained in grasping. This is what we normally call love. Is this what we mean by God as love? Let us see another idea of love. Love is an emotion. I am now not using the word sensation. I am using the word emotion. Love is an emotion. An emotion full of joy. Is that enough? An emotion full of joy, shall we call it love, or something more is needed? From your experience, you compare experiences with experiences. I see a beautiful sunrise. There is an experience of joy, emotion of joy. Shall we call it love? I see only sunrise. No, you don't call it love. So this definition is not correct. mere emotion of joy is not love. But joy is a part of love. Wherever there is love, there is joy. But wherever there is joy, is not necessarily that there is love. So apart from joy, there must be something else. Pardon? Unity, good. There is a joy of union. Now in that joy of union, at a human level, there is some kind of merchandise, some kind of bargaining. I am uniting myself with you and I expect a return from you in the same way. This is a human love in which there is a union, but there is a condition. This is not the case of divine as love. There is reciprocity, but no bargaining. The emotion of unity is not dependent upon the return. It is basically the union in which there is a self-giving. There may be a reciprocity of self-giving from the other side, but not as a condition. It is independent of reciprocity. So the essence of divine as love is not reciprocity in the experience of union, but basically an experience of self-giving. It's an outpouring. Outpouring, constantly uniting, constantly informing the object. In every experience of love, there is an object. And there is an outpouring towards an object. But this outpouring has no bargaining. There is the experience of union, but not dependent upon bargaining. That is what differentiates human love from the divine love. There is an unreserved pouring. There are huge pulsations of love. The joy is, of course, a part of this experience, but more than joy is union. A constant outpouring. The basic experiences of union, not merely of joy. So now, you have arrived at the essence of the idea of God as love. Where there is unrestrained outpouring of emotional joy, expressing union in which there is total unconditionality. There is no condition. Now, once you have got this essence of the idea of God as love, you meditate on this essence in such a way that various aspects, various manifestations of this love arise luminously in our heart. So meditation is not thinking about love. It may be only a starting point. A real meditation must ultimately aim at the awakening of an experience of various states, various manifestations. Divine smile is one of the manifestations. and you should therefore experience the divine smile, the captivating smile of the Lord. And that is an experience in which we can dwell. That is, meditation is dwelling. It's not only developing the idea of God as smile, that is only a starting point, but you should be able to dwell in the experience of the divine smile. The divine health is another experience. The divine outpouring itself into you, uplifting you from your difficulties, even without being asked. It is unconditional. So if you experience the divine uplifting you, even unasked, you may not even know that you are in difficulty. But he knows that you are in difficulty. So even unasked, he simply uplifts you. In every experience of divine love, there is always this experience that this love uplifts you constantly. You are drawn closer and closer from all the meshes, all the mess that you have made of our life, and he lifts us up from the mud. And this is another experience we should manifest. The divine love also manifests itself as a giver of knowledge. Divine love as the carrier of knowledge. So that when divine love manifests, all aspects of knowledge begin to develop in you. You blossom. There is a blossoming of your faculties. And as its faculty develops, there is no labor in it. It's a joy. It develops with a tremendous experience of self-giving. The faculties develop because the faculties throw themselves by the attraction of love. There is strain, but this strain is full of joy. That is a special experience of divine as love. It is like a flower, the sunflower turning towards the sun without any effort. It's a joy and the whole flower blooms. There is also another experience of divine as love. There is also the experience of divine love making a command. But such a command is a speciality of God as love, in which command is felt as something to which you want to serve with all your heart. It is not a command in which you feel, my Lord, now this command has come, how shall I fulfill? Then it is not a command, not a manifestation of divine as love. There are states in which God gives you command in which you feel too heavy for you. That is in karma yoga. When in karma yoga, when you are not attempting to reach God as love, then this kind of command that comes in the process of karma yoga, that joy is not a part of it. But here is a command which you really like so much. It is a condition in which you feel, oh, why God is not commanding me? I am waiting for command. I want to do. I want to serve. I want to be what he wants me to do. This is the experience of divine as love. It's a joy to hear the divine command. There's a dance in our being on hearing that this is what He wants. And I'm here at the feet of the Lord. And you don't mind whether your faculties to do it or not. The very fact that you have received the command is itself a great joy. You are so grateful. And you know that if the command has come, He will do it. Even if you are absolutely incapable of carrying out the command, He will do it. That is an experience of divine as love. Then divine as your companion. Friendship with the divine. In which you can behave with the Lord as though you can walk with Him. Not exactly as equals, but as a companion. The Lord walks with you. That is also God as love. And wherever He walks, you find a paradise. To be with God, walking with Him in a paradise. Everything is so beautiful. Everything is so favorable. The sun does not scorch you. Even if there is a tremendous sunlight, it gives you coolness. The breezes are all full of scent. All kinds of flowers are in the scent of the air. This is your experience when you have divine as love. Now these experiences should luminously rise in the heart. This is called meditation. One after the other, all these experiences begin to develop and you dwell upon them. Alright, this is called meditation. Now Sri Aurobindo only comments upon it and says, the thought may come first and the experience afterwards. But equally, the experience may come first and the knowledge arise out of the experience. If you read Mother's book called The Meditations, Prayers and Meditations of the Mother, you then learn what are meditations. Every line that is given there is a meditation coming out of the experience. The thoughts which are expressed are only the results of experiences. Ordinary meditation is only thinking. Thinking on one subject with concentration. But that is only a preliminary meditation. It is only when you get the essence of the idea and when you dwell upon the essence of the idea and when that essence of the idea begins to manifest in your heart in various aspects of its experience, then you say, I have meditated. That is the real meditation. Afterwards, the thing attained has to be dwelt on and more held till it becomes a constant experience and finally the dharma or law of the being. When you have meditated for years and years in this fashion, then in a second you can walk with God with that love in the paradise. You don't need to make an effort. It has become part of your being. You can converse with Him. You can receive commands from Him with great joy. Your whole being is constantly tuned to the divine will. You know, when Mother says to live in Auroville, one must be a willing servitor of divine consciousness. It means that already you should arrive at that point when you want to do what the divine wants, whatever may be the consequence. Willing servitor, I want to be servant of the divine. Servant of servants. If anybody else is serving the divine, I want to be servant of that person who is serving the divine. It is such an experience that you cannot do but this. That is the dharma of your being. You become so much tuned to it. Again and again you ask the divine, I have done this, what more? I still want to pour myself at your feet. Again and again, endlessly. This is meditation. All right. Now we come to contemplation. The result of contemplation also is the same as the result of meditation. Now Sri Aurobindo says, this is the process of concentrated meditation. But a more strenuous method, contemplation is a more strenuous method. Got it? Strenuous, more laborious. Where there is a strain, you get strain. But a more strenuous method is the fixing of the whole mind in concentration on the essence of the idea only, so as to reach not the thought knowledge or the psychological experience of the subject, but the very essence of the thing behind the idea. There is a difference between essence of the idea and the essence of the thing. In the case of meditation, we were told of the essence of the idea, the essential idea. And then we were allowed, by the help of essential idea, to dwell upon various manifestations of the experience corresponding to that idea. There was, as it were, a successive movement. In meditation, there is a successive movement. At every time, you get one manifestation of the experience of divine as love. Now, here in the contemplation, there is not an attempt to reach the psychological experience even, but the very essence of the thing itself. You enter into the heart of God Himself, not manifestations of God as love. But you enter into the heart, essence of God Himself. In this process, thought ceases and passes into the absorbed or ecstatic contemplation of the object, or by merging into it in an inner samadhi. In the ordinary life, we often have this experience of contemplation. You have heard the story of Shakuntala. Have you? No. Shakuntala was a daughter of the famous rishi called Vishwamitra, but brought up by another rishi called Kanva. That rishi's name was Kanva. Kanva was a rishi who had a very big ashram, like Auroville. So many students were studying, boys and girls. Once upon a time, when Shakuntala had already grown into a maiden, a beautiful woman, the king of the domain, who was in a process of hunting, missing the deer whom he wanted to hunt, exhausted, enters into the ashram. And he is thirsty, wants to drink water. And three girls were moving about in the garden of the ashram. One of them was Shakuntala. And the moment Shakuntala saw Dushyanta, that was the name of the king, and the moment he saw her, there was a love at first sight between the two. And thereafter, she couldn't live without the presence of Dushyanta. Kanva Rishi at that time was absent from the hermitage. And Dushyanta and Shakuntala married by one of the processes of marriage, which was a simple ceremony of marriage. And then Dushyanta was called away by his mother in the kingdom for an urgent work. And he promised Shakuntala that he will return or will send his great chariot to take her as a queen to his kingdom. And Shakuntala was now left alone. Now in that state, she fell into contemplation of Dushyanta. It was not merely thinking of Dushyanta, not merely experiencing what she had experienced, but holding Dushyanta himself in her heart, the thing itself. And that was such an absorption that when a guest, another rishi, came and called out to Shakuntala to receive him, she did not hear at all the call of her great rishi. This is the mark of a deep contemplation, which happens even in ordinary human life. There are intense states of consciousness in which the object, the essence of the object, is dwelt upon by the mind. And you are one with the object. You don't need to make any kind of thinking. You straight go into the heart, the essence of the thing itself. This happens also in our ordinary process of pursuit of knowledge. When you have understood an idea, not when you are in pursuit of understanding an idea, but when you have understood an idea, imagine anything that you have understood, and that understanding, when you have arrived at understanding, you feel a great joy in understanding, in having understood. Now you are not in the process of understanding, so there is no successive movement. You are now only centered upon that what you have understood. And that understanding goes on developing so deeply that the object which is understood is seized by you. You feel as if now you have gone beyond the idea. You have come not only beyond the essence of the idea, you have entered into the very object. That is called contemplation. Many philosophers, when they have reached a certain height of understanding, they reach a stage of contemplation. They are fixed upon, they have understood that there is no process of understanding. But what is understood is so full of joy, or such a tremendous seizing of the idea, that there is no need to develop that idea. No need to develop the experiences behind ideas which manifest. At once from that understanding, you enter into the object itself. You seize the very object in your consciousness. Now, if the object is the divine love in this process, then as opposed or as distinguished from what you are experiencing in the process of meditation, where different states of love arise one after the other and experience those different states of consciousness, here you directly experience the heart of God Himself. And you enjoy merely it by dwelling upon that heart of the divine. The divine is possessed by you. Now, Sri Aurobindo says further, if this be the process followed, then subsequently, the state into which we rise must still be called down to take possession of the lower being, to shed its light, power and bliss on our ordinary consciousness. Once you have caught hold of the divine Himself, then you allow the divine light, divine joy, divine power to come down in our lower consciousness. For otherwise, we may possess it, as many do, in the elevated condition or in the inward samadhi, but we shall lose our hold of it when we awake or descend into the context of the world. And this truncated position is not the aim of the integral yoga. When you go up, you can hold divine. When you come down, divine is lost. And you fall into the trap of the world as it is. That is a truncated experience. One leg upward, one leg downward. But here you come fully. Even the lower leg is also uplifted and remains uplifted all the time. Now Sri Aurobindo speaks of a third process. A process which is neither of concentrated meditation or of contemplation, but another process. Let us read it. We had only thought of contemplation, but it is better to finish now all the three processes. So we know very clearly how the three processes of concentration stand in our consciousness verified. Once you know these three processes, you have known all that is to be known about concentration. It's a complete science which Sri Aurobindo has given in one page. Complete science of concentration. People have written books on this subject. In one page Sri Aurobindo has given the complete statement of what is concentration. So, without reading so many books, you just read this page again and again. You will understand it better and better as you experience more and more. Very often these words do not convey much meaning to us because we haven't got the experience of it. But the more we do it, the more we shall experience and the more we shall understand. Now comes the third process. A third process is neither at first to concentrate in a strenuous meditation on the one subject, nor in a strenuous contemplation of the one object of thought vision, but first to still the mind altogether. There is neither a subject nor the object. You just still the mind, make it quiet. Sometimes this is more difficult than the other two processes. But sometimes it is much easier You don't have to make any strenuous movement of meditation or contemplation. Just be quiet. And after that quietude, you see that there are no ripples of thought, no waves of thought, and the mind sits absolutely still. And dwell upon it. That is also a concentration. Now this may be done by various ways. One is to stand back from the mental action altogether. Not participating in, but simply watching it until tired of its unsanctioned leaping and running, it falls into an increasing and finally an absolute quiet. Now there are three things to be considered here. You can stand back from the mental action. That is to say, there is a mental action going on. This mental action which is going on is quite a noisy affair of a market. It is as if we are in a bazaar in which there is hustle and bustle and a tremendous amount of activity going on. So imagine that you are in a bazaar in which lots of currents are going on. Then you stand back. You experience as if even though there is a movement of bazaar, we are only watching it. You do not participate in the movement of thinking. It is like going to a market in which you are constantly being attracted by this sight, this shop or that shop, beautiful objects lying around. You are attracted to buy this or to buy that. This is what we are constantly about. Our entire mind movement is like going to a market in which you are constantly being lured by various sights and calls and sounds and things and objects of various kinds. And constantly you are judging, this is right, this is not right, good, bad, I don't like this, I don't like that. All this marketing going on. Now imagine, however, that although you are in a market, you decide now that you are not going to buy anything. You are only watching. You are only a witness in the market. You stand apart and you see hustle, bustle, everything that is going on. Now this is a very important step in which you stand back from the mental activity. That is to say, there is in you somebody who can stand back. This whole psychology is based upon the perception that there is something in you which can withdraw from the market of the mind and which can watch without taking interest in what is going on. This is the process that Swami Vivekananda very much suggested to many people. Even Sri Aurobindo, in some of his letters on yoga, he has recommended this process. When you do not want to meditate, you do not want to contemplate, then this is a very easy process. You just stand back from the mental turmoil. And then, even that market in which you are engaged or even watching, you will find that even that market will fall quiet. And this will enable you to experience yourself as different from the market altogether. And a great quietude will automatically enter into you. To be seated in that quietude is a state of concentration. Now there is another method of arriving at the same result. Another is to reject the thought suggestions, to cast them away from the mind whenever they come, and firmly hold on to the peace of the being which really and always exists behind the trouble and riot of the mind. There is always a peace in you, but we do not see this peace because there is a riot of the mind all the time, a rush of the ideas. This was the method that Sri Aurobindo himself followed when his teacher said, thoughts come to you from outside, before they enter, you fling them back. So, is to reject the thought suggestions, to cast them away from the mind whenever they come, and firmly hold to the peace of the being which really and always exists behind the trouble and riot of the mind. When this secret peace is unveiled, a great calm settles on the being. And there comes usually with it the perception and experience of the all-pervading silent Brahman. Everything else at first seeming to be mere form and eidolon. On the basis of this calm, everything else may be built up in the knowledge and experience, no longer of the external phenomena of things, but of the deeper truth of the divine manifestation. So, this is a third method of concentration. So, if you ask, what are these three methods of concentration? One is meditation. Second is contemplation. And the third is the method by which peace of the mind is seized upon. Now let us read the last paragraph. It is just to complete our entire understanding. Ordinarily, once this state is obtained, strenuous concentration will be found no longer necessary. You become master. You don't need to have strains. Even when there's all the noise going on, you are seated in the Brahman all the time. There is no strain at all. A free concentration of will, using thought merely for suggestion, and the giving of light to the lower members will take its place. If there is obscurity, and you want that obscurity to become clear, a mere thought suggestion that this obscurity be cleared, the higher consciousness will come down on obscurity, and obscurity will be cleared. There is no strain. You just will on that plane where there is a constant peace or a constant state of experience of divine as love or whatever. There are many aspects of the divine. Once you have attained to this, then there is a very comfortable, very easy process. A mere will works itself out. This is called siddhi. You arrive at a great mastery. This will then insist on the physical being, the vital existence, the heart and the mind, remolding themselves in the forms of the divine, which reveal themselves out of the silent Brahman. By swifter or slower degrees, according to the previous preparation and purification of the members, they will be obliged with more or less struggle to obey the law of the will and its thought suggestion, so that eventually the knowledge of the divine takes possession of our consciousness on all its planes, and the image of the divine is formed in our human existence, even as it was done by the old Vedic sadhakas. For the integral yoga, this is the most direct and powerful discipline. So, you can approach this by meditation, or by contemplation, or by quieting the mind. And the mind is quieted, you don't need meditation or contemplation. You can simply will anything, and then our lower parts of the being are bathed into the higher consciousness. And whatever is to be transformed is transformed, until at last we, the human image, becomes the divine image. That is the real Siddhi, Yoga Siddhi. All right, this was only a comment upon a word which we are reading in the chapter on the four aids, where Sri Aurobindo speaks of the Shastra of the old on which we are to meditate, on page number 49. Page 49. Fifth line, no? On page number 49, line number 5 from the top. The spiritual knowledge is then gained through meditation on the truths that are taught, and it is made living and conscious by the realization in the personal experience. So when we read this book, Sri Aurobindo has told us how we should read this book. The truths which are mentioned here, you should meditate on them, either by strenuous meditation or contemplation, or in the third way of quieting the minds and listening to what is given here, and then comes the realization of the truths. The yoga proceeds by the results of prescribed methods taught in a scripture or a tradition, and reinforced and illumined by the instructions of the master. This is a narrower practice. We had decided last time, why is it a narrower practice? Because you are still moving on the beaten track. So it's a safe. When you read this book and you follow it out, it is a safe movement, because all this has been realized by the master. And you only repeat in your own personal experience what has been realized by the master. Afterwards, you can make an adventure, a larger process. What is not given in Shastra, even that you can develop. When you read the mother's agenda, she says, Sri Aurobindo did not tell us the secret, although he has written all this. But mother says, Sri Aurobindo left without telling us a secret. Therefore, there is nothing to meditate upon. So there was an adventure. She says, I am walking blindfolded. And she built a new path. So mother's agenda is another Vedic Shastra. What is not given in Sri Aurobindo was then given by the mother. That is why this book is to be followed by the agenda. And Mother herself has said, agenda is a continuation of the synthesis of yoga. So much of the path has been trodden for us, and it is made easy for us so that we can tread. Now, Sri Aurobindo makes a very important comment. For the sadhaka of the integral yoga, it is necessary to remember that no written shastra, however great its authority, or however large its spirit, can be more than a partial expression of the eternal knowledge. This applies even to this book, even to the agenda. That is why there is no religion possible. There is no final stop. It's an open book in which new chapters are to be added, because there is no end of the eternal knowledge. For the sadhaka of the integral yoga, it is necessary to remember that no written shastra, however great its authority, or however large its spirit, can be more than a partial expression of the eternal knowledge. He will use, but never bind himself, even by the greatest scripture. Where the scripture is profound, wide, catholic, it may exercise upon him an influence for the highest good and of incalculable importance. It may be associated in this experience with his awakening to crowning verities and his realization of the highest experiences. His yoga may be governed for a long time by one scripture or by several successively. If it is in the line of the great Hindu tradition, by the Gita, for example, the Upanishads, the Veda, or it may be a good part of his development to include in his material a richly varied experience of the truths of many scriptures and make the future opulent with all that is best in the past. But in the end, he must take his station, or better still, if he can, always and from the beginning, he must live in his own soul, beyond the written truths. Brahma, Shabda Brahma Ati Vartate, he goes beyond any world, beyond all that he has heard, and all that he has yet to hear. Shrotavyasya Shrutasya cha. For he is not a sadhak of a book or of many books. He is a sadhaka of the infinite. Therefore, no prisoner of any word. I think we can stop here, no? We should remember this last line. He is not the sadhaka of a book or of many books. He is a sadhaka of the infinite.